You are now listening to Grinding True Crime Podcast with your host, Maddie Matt, Todd Fox, and Gabby Gap.
Police have identified more victims and plan on more than just the four murder charges filed today.
Confirm earlier reports of cannibalism.
The building was a scene of ghoulish slaughter.
A large kettle on the stove which held boiled body parts.
Identified more victims and
killed even more.
Plan on more than just the four murder charges filed today.
Had sex with some of his victims before he killed them, and that he was also a necrophiliac.
Hey, welcome into another episode of Grinding True Crimes. I am your host, Todd Fox, along with our host,
Randy Oz,
checking in with us as we're doing another show without the trio, but it's okay. We'll get to that at some point. Scheduling stuff still is a mess. A lot of stuff going on. But you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts, and you could watch the audio versions turn into video over there on YouTube via Randy Yaws and his One Jets Pod doing the editing. So if you want to check out Grinding True Crime, we'd appreciate a like and subscribe over there. And we are doing our normal stuff here on Grinding True Crimes, just a little bit different, though, with the two hosts for today's show. And we got a juicy woman, man. How you been, first off?
I've been well, man. How about yourself?
Good. Enjoying that the weather's changing. And this, and we're in California, as most people know. And we've done several California. And I'm just going to say, screw it. We got a lot more California cases to go.
There's just killing fools over here.
Yeah. It's not only the most expensive place to live, but it can be the most dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people disappear. There's some weird cases over here, too. They're not your everyday normal cases. That's for damn sure.
For sure.
And that's going to be no different in this case. We're going to start off with a case about the trail killer in Northern California.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's going to be a good one. As far as that's concerned, one other thing I just want to get the business out of the way. If you want to check out our social media stuff, please like and subscribe to that stuff too, or just, you know, give us a shout out. I think I'm going to try to have Randy work on the Grinding True Crime page, because that one needs to take off over there on Instagram. We're doing pretty good on Facebook. Yeah, we need some more advertising over there. And as far as, like, if you want to pick up some merchandise, we got some new stuff coming at the start of this month. But check over on Etsy.com under Grinding True Crime. You could find our page over there and get some merch as well. Some t-shirts, wine glasses, stuff like that. For now, we got some more designs coming. So let's get into the story, my man.
Let's do it.
All right. So we are now going to be starting in Northern California. And this case, again, is going to be one that was back in the day highly, highly publicized. And so we're going to talk about one David Joseph Carpenter.
David Joseph Carpenter, DJC.
DJC, yeah. He was born May 6, 1930 in San Francisco, California. Okay. So, yeah. And how often, bro, do we talk about on this show? And we've done episodes of Matt and Gabby, obviously you and James, and a few others that have joined on, but how many times do we talk about serial killers having certain traits, certain things?
Almost every episode.
Yeah, this one's no different. Because the last one we did with Matt and Gabby, you know, the railroad killer, you know, he had the bike accident, no helmet, that he was never the same after that accident. Right. And there's certain things that contribute to, Let's see if you can name a couple that contribute to a serial killer. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay. Well, definitely number one's head injury.
Okay.
And then obviously I would say this is like 1A and 1B. The next one would be cruelty or harming animals.
Correct. That's another one.
And getting pleasure out of it.
Yes. Yes. And then can you give us one more? Let's see if you can get all three, or at least the three.
Man, just overly crazy.
Well, I mean, there is that too, the manic depressant, you have bipolarism, that stuff plays a part, but That was I was looking, Vanna, for Vanna White. Now I was looking for a not a vowel, but I was looking for maybe, you know, abuse by family members.
Physical, verbal, or sexual. Absolutely. Yes.
Correct. There's that. And then there's also personality traits too, like wetting the bed, anger issues, like you brought up, stuff like that. So there's quite a few. But you did good. You did good.
Appreciate it.
So with this one though, this one had to do with a non-stable family environment.
Ah, okay.
So in this household, a young David, his father, which again plays a huge role, because the father can either set a good example for the son and send him on a wonderful path to becoming a better human being and a better adult as he grows up, give him the right kind of traits, whether it be through religion, through your just basic values, what have you. But he could also do the exact opposite and torture the kid, make him hate life, and then make whoever comes into your son's path give them a tough time because of how you raised your son. Not saying that's the excuse, but it could put him on that bad path.
Right.
And this one, there was a lot of physical and mental abuse on David through his father, Elwood, because Elwood was a raging alcoholic.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. He would come home just, you know, busting through the door like, "Hey, kids, get over here!" And then they come see him, and then he just like slap them upside the head, you know, tell them they're good for nothing, stuff like that.
That reminds me of guys like my buddy's dad. He always seemed like one of those guys that he'd go to work, get bossed around, had no power, and then had to come home and exert all the power that he could at home because this is my home. You know, I had a rough day, and I finally got some power, and I'm gonna take it out on whoever. And just be getting drunk, you know, the whole time.
Yeah, and that sucks. That's that inferior complex, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, it sucks. So on one hand, we're gonna break down how he grew up, but on one hand, you know, you're getting abused by your father physically, so he's slapping him, punching him, kicking him. He's his pink flamingo at the front of your house, you know, you kick every time when you're pissed off going to work.
Oh yeah.
You know, he's taking the brunt of, like you said, good example, your friend's father. And to make things even worse, his mother, on the other side, is a strong, vibrant, religious, what is it called? A micromanaging type mother. Everything he did, she looked into, questioned him. And she was physically abusive to him as well. So it wasn't like, hey, you know, because back then in the day, it was okay to whip a kid with a belt. And I think, in my opinion, it still should be a thing today if you're keeping it below the waist and on the butt where it should be, as long as you're not hitting the legs and the back and stuff like that. I mean, kids need discipline. That's just me.
In the late 30s, early 40s. I mean, my daddy used to tell me stories about my grandmama pulling. And I'm not kidding, Todd. Rose thorns switches and beating his butt with the switches with the thorns in them, dude. And my dad's butt just bleeding. So yeah, dude. Like back in the day, it was crazy, dude. Like you could get away with borderline killing your kids, man.
Yeah, you even threaten to spank some of these kids nowadays, and they got CPS on speed dial.
Oh, so. You're done.
Yeah, exactly. So this was not the nuclear family that a lot of people were, you know, are raised in, or fortunate people are raised in today, where they have the mother and the father. He had his mother and the father, but they had their issues, and they took it out on the children. So he faced a lot of crap growing up. So his mother, Frances, here's another thing that she did. She never got the daughter that she wanted. And
oh, well, there it is.
Yes. So she was trying to make him the daughter of the house. And I forgot to say, you know, he didn't have any other brothers and sisters. It was just him. So I meant kid instead of kid. So I apologize. But Francis enrolled him in ballet and piano. So we're talking about a kid from the age of six And again, nowadays it's more accepted if you see boys in ballet, if you see boys in cheerleading. But go back 10 years ago, that wouldn't have flown. And then go back into the 30s.
1937-ish?
Yeah, around that time.
Yeah, and he got roasted.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, this
dude, this kid was so unhappy and just angry all the time, dude.
Oh, yeah, he must have been. On the outside, it was said he was more of like, he looked timid because, you know, he wore glasses. You know, they dressed him very proper. But, you know, I guess, like you said, he must have been just boiling, like you said, fuming on the inside.
Oh, yeah.
And just, or just if he wasn't mad, he was just depressed.
For sure. You know?
So he had to, you know, while other friends of his, the ones that didn't make fun of him, because you're absolutely right. I was just going to say that his friends growing up through middle school, elementary, were just picked on him constantly. But the friends he did have, he was jealous because they got to play baseball. They got to, you know, their fathers engaged with them at camping and stuff like that while he was doing ballet. And he was the only boy doing it. He was playing piano every day, you know. So this is a kid that is doing stuff that he's not happy with at all.
I bet he's the kind of kid that would go spend the night at a friend's house, not see his buddy or whatever, get beat on and think, this doesn't seem like a normal home.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've had friends like that, dude.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, dude. Well, my buddy I've telling you about, he would come over and spend the night on the weekend, you know, back when we were like fifth and sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, man, it's crazy, man. Your parents don't sit there and just yell at you and you don't get spankings and shit. I was like, no, I get spankings. I go, but I have to get in trouble.
Yeah.
And he was just tripping, dude. Like, he would always want to come over.
Mm.
You know how that is. I mean, I'm not saying you know how that is, but, like, you know how that is with some kids, man. They get abused at home, and they don't want to be there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They find somewhere else where it's like, man, I can come here and just be chilling, you know, just not get hit on and just play video games and just shoot the crap. Like, I couldn't get rid of my buddy. He was always over there, dude.
Yeah, my first ever best friend committed suicide because of that. That's you know, cool. We were too young to see the warning signs, and then when everything came out of the end, you know, everything made sense. Wow. You know, he's getting abused sexually by his stepfather, and then his mother and father would beat him at their house. He had really no outlet, so yeah, that would be the thing where he was coming over a lot to our friend's house, my house, spending the night. You know, because he saw how my mom and dad treated me, and you know,
he's probably too scared to tell anybody too, and probably thought if he did tell anybody, nobody would believe him.
Yeah,
oh, your dad, come on.
I wish he would have spoke up. He would have been here today.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it's just one of those tough things, man. And you know, some kids.
Sorry,
I mean, no, it's okay. It's just it's amazing, you know, because he should be my age right now. You know,
wow.
Just passed away so long ago. That's only 13. Only 13 years old, man. So, so this is what could have happened to this guy, David. You know, he's going through this stuff. He's getting attacked on every side. Mm-hmm. He's got no safe haven, though. He's not allowed to spend the night at people's houses. So,
damn.
So we're getting into the 50s now, or the late 40s here, and you know he's in high school now, and you know he doesn't have that male figure to help him, you know, find his masculinity, you know, and become that not dominant male, but just establish himself as a young and up and coming teenager as you do. Cause I mean,
right.
Like there are men that grow up and, you know, they're feminine. That's fine. Or, you know, they're either straight or they're not. And that's up to them. And, but this is a different time period. You know, you got to hit certain miles.
Yeah, even in the '50s society hadn't changed over the last 20 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, the longer he's in ballet, it's almost the more traumatic and more dangerous for him growing up.
Yeah.
So he would lash out on certain things such as animals, you know, because he would get, you know, animals really can't say anything or fight back. And
right.
He's not a big guy. He's not going to intimidate anybody. So. And he had no one to talk to. He would sometimes just mutter to himself, have conversations with himself. And he had a real hard time like just relating to anybody in general that was male, you know, because the only people that paid attention to him and then went to these piano lessons or piano recitals and ballet, you know, events were mostly female.
Yeah.
And a lot of the females that were there did not like him being there either. But
yeah, they probably even thought it was a little weird back then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So as he got older, you know, he developed a little bit of acne. He wasn't able to talk to girls, even though the majority of the people that he went, like I said, to these things were females. He just was very, very awkward, mm-hmm. you know, and there's no bigger brother to be like, hey, here's how you talk to a girl, or any best friends to be like, hey, man, just follow my lead. Stuff like that. Nobody took him under his wing. And as he got older, his father was just drinking more and didn't give two, you know, what's about him. His mom was just on him. Man. So right now you're feeling sorry for him right now.
I do, you know, and yeah. Some of these guys, you almost have to feel sorry for him because it seems like as kids, they had no shot.
Yep. Yep. Now here's
what when a kid has no shot, man.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when the kid is behind the eight ball the entire time, you do feel bad.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say right now, that's going to stop.
Right there. Oh, man. I guess we got a date.
No, we don't have a date, but we have a time period to where you're like, okay, because not a date yet, but we do have a time period where you're like, okay, enough feeling sorry for David. Okay. Because no matter how he was raised, how you were raised, how I was raised, even if we're in a bad household, you still have to make this conscientious decision on your own. Nobody's making you do this.
Right.
This is all you. So this is where it got me right here. So around 1947, so he's about 16, going to be 17 years old. He had gotten in trouble and incarcerated in juvenile hall. And let's see if you can guess. For what?
I'm gonna guess killing an animal.
No, wasn't caught for that. I'll give you one more shot because it's something that would make you mad if you heard about this.
Oh man! Shit.
And he was put in a psychiatric facility as well.
For doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing rape somebody.
Close. Well, I guess basically you can call it that, but he molested for about a 2-month period his two cousins that were 8 years old and 3 years old.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Man. So again, all the love or the, you know, the feeling sorry for David is long gone at this point.
No, at that age, you know better. I don't care what you've been through. You know that's bad.
Absolutely. And again, nobody forces you to do that stuff. You know, that's on your own impulses.
Gabby says, off with his wang.
Yeah, we right there would have been nice to take his wang. I mean, you know what I mean? By the way, in other contexts, that would sound very sus, but I just said.
Oh, man.
But this is 1947, and when he's in this facility, the psychiatric facility, and he's in juvenile hall, the worst they diagnose him with is, get this, antisocial behavior. That's it. So
basically babies.
Yes. And they don't categorize him as a pedophile.
Oh, I mean, you're damn near 18 years old.
Yeah. So, and again, that term was alive and well back then. I mean, they've been calling people a pedophile that touch kids since the turn of the 1900th century, at least. And they didn't categorize this douche with that at all. You know, they were just like, oh, he's antisocial. You know, that's why he lashed out. Hey, y'all, this guy's just got a little bit of problems. Nothing a little bit of bear will call, you know, you grow some hair on his chest, he'll be fine. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's your Johnson, Randy.
All right.
the psychiatrist. So
they're infiltrating everywhere.
Oh, yeah. They sure are, man. But another thing that takes place with his sexual deviance or serial killers is sometimes they are, you know, they have this trait in their body for whatever reason. Even if they weren't touched, they have an overactive sex drive. And this is the case for David growing up. Like, he, despite him having any kind of real experience or whatever, his sex drive is, to him, is really pushing him to do things that he shouldn't do. Wow. And so in 1955, he met a woman by the name of Ellen, and they would get married, you know, right after, you know, in 55. And they would have three kids by 1960.
Okay.
So he's getting it in there, you know what I mean? And
in those, be having kids, but all right.
Exactly. But thankfully, you know, with all the information we have, he didn't do anything to his children.
Well, thank God.
So at least there's that. But by 1960, David's sex drive was getting more and more, like, just out of control. And according to his wife, she was having sex with him no less than three times a day.
Oh, wow.
And this is 5 years into the relationship. So it's not like the newlywed sex where you're like, oh, man, you know, like, say, for instance, you're staying pure and you know, you don't really have that premarital sex. And you're like, you know, basically like Mormons, and you're having sex for the first time after marriage, and you're just like banging it out like two cats and dogs or whatever like that. Yep. You know, like like he's like 5 years in, like, get over here, honey.
Man, three times a day, every day.
Dude, I wish I could do that, like, once a week. That'd be great.
I bet you she was in a wheelchair, bro.
I know. This guy is just, like, going at it, man. And this is to the point where the wife is telling him, okay, can we stop? Like, she's looking forward not to having sex. Can we just have a night off? Like, a perfect date night with me, honey, would be like, let's just go have dinner and go to sleep and stay away from the vagina. You know, but wow. What's that?
I said, poor girl.
Oh, I know. I mean, must have been some friction going on down there. But anyway, bad chafing. Yeah, he's just all around focused on sex all the time, thinking about it. He would see coworkers, you know, that were female and kind of give, you know, where he was working at the time, odd stares, you know, like people walking down the street that were female. Like, he was just having sexual thoughts in his mind too when he's at work. You know, he can't wait to get home and maybe take out a fantasy on his wife, but while he was at work, he was thinking about women on the street. So he he has an opportunity where he just can't have, you know, like, obviously he's 5 years into his marriage. He's 30 years old at this point, and he's in work. He's doing pretty good. In late November 1960, date quite not unknown, but in 1960, towards the end of the year, David takes a chance. All these thoughts that have been coming through his mind over the last few months, he's starting to feel it. He wants to act on his sexual urges. So his adrenaline is pumping. And he has been fond over this girl that works in the reception area called Lois Rinna. And she's outside of the place where they work, and she's just waiting for someone to pick her up. He takes the opportunity to get behind her and throw her into the back seat of his car, lock the doors, and speed off.
What? Just like that, huh?
Just like that. He's a coworker.
Not even a, hey, how you doing?
It's not a stranger. It's not a, hey, yeah, like, can I take you out for coffee, or do you need a ride?
So he basically kidnapped her.
Pretty much. Just threw her in the back seat of the car and took off.
Okay.
So he's driving into the
forest. We're off to the races.
Yes, right away. I mean, this goes from 0 to 60 real quick. So he drives into the forest in Northern California. Like, it's to the east of the Bay Area. over there at the time, there was a lot of military bases that were being taken down or just abandoned at the time because, you know, the war was over. There wasn't really a need for all those bases on the West Coast because they had built up a lot during World War II. So he takes her into this area that was abandoned, and his whole mindset from start to finish was, I'm going to kidnap her, I'm going to rape her, and I'm going to murder her. So there's no escalation, Randy, where he starts off with a kidnapping rape or maybe like a fondling or maybe a stalking, and then you work yourself up. This guy's just like, I'm doing this.
Planned murder.
So for me, what do you think about this? My impression when I was researching this is that he just didn't come up with that idea that day. If all that sex with his wife and everything else like that, I think this was a fantasy of his probably shortly after he got married, right?
Yeah, that's got to be something that's been with you for a while.
Yeah, I mean he's...
Yeah, I don't think that's just something that just, hey, you know what? Hey, yeah, that sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, it wasn't one of those things like, you know what? I woke up today a little frisky. I think I'm going to rape somebody. I'm going to, after I kidnap him, and then I'll probably kill him, you know? But, before I get into that, real interesting, another side story that was part of this, but it was like, you know, something similar that someone wrote. It was an experience of them picking up a hitchhiker, and it was a woman. She picked up this guy and she drove him to, you know, because he's like, oh, can you drive me into the city? And then she's like, yeah, but I'll do you one better. I'm hungry right now. And, you know, like, I've been driving for a while. Can I pick you up something at this diner? You know, I'll treat. And the guy's like, well, I don't have any money. You know, I don't want to put you out like that. She's like, no, I got it. So they had dinner. They were exchanging pleasantries, had a great time. She takes him into the city, drops him off exactly where he wants to go. And he's like, can I get your number? Because this happened in like the 80s. He goes, can I get your number? And, you know, I can call you back and, you know, just we can catch up like in a week. He's like, I had such a great time. I'm not hitting on you. Just, you know, I think you're a cool person. I'd like, maybe we could be pen pals or friends. Uh-huh. So she writes her number down, thinks nothing of it, right? Uh-huh. A week later, the guy calls. Doesn't let her get a word in edgewise and says, you know what? I just got one tip for you. Never, ever, ever pick up a hitchhiker. He's like, before you had that smile on your face and were so nice to me, he goes, I couldn't find it in my mind, and I would never forgive myself if I went through what I was intending to do. He's like, I was intending to rape and murder you. And he goes, because you were so nice and because the way your personality is, I didn't want to take someone's daughter that is a good person. He goes, yeah, he told her straight up, take care of yourself and please be careful, and hung up on her just like that.
Dude,
insane, right?
Could you imagine getting that phone call, bro?
It freaked her out.
Wow. I could imagine just sitting there thinking, man, I could have died that. I would have been dead that night if I would just turned around and just, you know, took him to the city and dropped him off. I'd have been dead.
Yeah, he would have. He said he had a knife, would have just killed her, cut her up. So yeah,
that's
crazy.
That's why I don't do hitchhikers, bro.
Yeah, male or female, it doesn't matter.
I don't care. You ain't getting in my car.
Oh, it's raining. That person's over there. Sorry. Here's an umbrella.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's about it. But getting back to the story. He's driving up this hill past, you know, he kind of like blows through this fence that's closed. You know how in those movies where the car just blows through a fence that's kind of chain linked. It's got like a little chain on it, and it just, boom, it opens up and the guy drives through. That's what happened here. He's driving his sedan right through the damn the fence. The problem is he doesn't see a guy who's on his break, who is Officer Hicks. He's a military policeman. In his Jeep, just parked behind a couple trees. He's out there just to watch for you know, vandalists or people trying to sneak into the base, even though it's not occupied. He's still got to protect it. And so he's like, what the hell? You know, it's like one of those movie things. He throws his coffee down, turns on a Jeep, and follows the car up the hill. So he's going up there, and as he's following, he's far behind at this point because, again, he's got to start up the Jeep. Jeeps aren't that fast. The sedan's right, going at a high rate of speed. So David gets to a part in the base where it's all wooded areas behind a couple buildings, parks his car, takes a screaming Lois out there. He's taunting her and he's slapping her and he's like, you know, you can't, you know, he starts tying her up and he's like, you know, you can scream all you want, nobody's going to hear her. And she, you know, she's got her hands tied behind her back. He twists her with these old metal hangers, you know, her ankles together. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, you know, he doesn't feel the need to rape her at the point, because at this one point, I mean, and I know it sounds terrible what I'm about to say, but if he had tried to rape her, maybe he takes enough time to where he doesn't penetrate her, or, you know, like if he's taking the time to strip her, maybe what happens right now doesn't happen and the alternative stuff does happen. It'll all make sense, Randy. So follow me on this one. Instead of trying to take her clothes off, he has her flat on her stomach. She's tied up from both ends, you know, with rope or zip ties on the back of her hand, the metal hanger with her ankles, so she's basically hogtied.
Damn.
He pulls out a claw hammer.
Aw, dude.
And he begins beating her immediately over the head, the back of the head. And that's what I meant about, like, man, if he had just tried to, like, struggle with taking her clothes off, you know, it would have given Officer Hicks enough time to get there, and she wouldn't have had the damage inflicted on her as what was inflicted on her.
Yeah.
So Hicks pulls up, finally. And he's hit her over the head by this point at least 4 or 5 times. He pulls out with his gun and is like, hey, put it down. He's yelling at him. And David looks at him, takes another shot to the back of her head, even harder.
Oh, I'd have shot him right in the head.
And Hicks again yells, put it down. And he he puts the hammer down to reach into his pocket, and he shot at Hicks. He had a .22 on him.
Hicks and, is a dummy then.
Yeah, Hicks should have opened fire. You're right.
The minute he took another shot at the back of her head, he should have fired the never ending shot right there. Dude should have took his ass out.
Yep.
That what kind of Johnson like there, Hicks?
Yeah, for a military man. I mean, maybe he wasn't. Maybe he just it took him a second to realize exactly the craziness of it. But he was shot. He shot at Hicks, and luckily it missed him. Like it missed his torso. And so Hicks returned fire, hitting David twice in the leg. And he went down to the ground. He rushed over Hicks, and right away, David being shot, he put the gun down right away, threw up his hands like a pussy. And you know, he was subdued, and then right away, you know, he's getting on his radio saying, hey, I need help up here. You know, his walkie-talkie or whatever. And somehow, some way, even in the, you know, the early 1960s, and having not the rescue, the kind of like helicopter to fly in to get her out, the whole, you know, trauma team that exists today, they were able to save her. She had her skull fractured in 3 different spots. And she would suffer brain damage and memory loss.
I don't see how you couldn't.
But she would survive. And she has a... do you know Lisa Rinna? The actress? She was on Days of Our Lives. Soap opera. She was on Taylor McBride Fox television series. She was on Melrose Place, Big Time Rush, CSI. That was her mother.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Lois Rinna. So Lisa Rinna, a famous actress here in America, she's that was her mother that suffered that attack before she was born. So had she not have survived, we would not have Lisa Rinna. So that's pretty crazy.
Wow.
So how long do you think he got for this? Because, again, he fired upon a civil servant or a active military policeman, and he attempted the murder. on Miss Rena. How long do you think California gave him for that?
Should have got life, but I'm guessing year or less.
He got 15 years.
Oh, wow.
He got 15 years, and he was incarcerated. Well, he was sentenced in 1962, so it took a year and a half of just about almost 2 years to go to court, and then he got the 15 years. However, taking into consideration his wife divorced him, the three kids didn't want anything to do with him. He lost out on his career at the time. He's a model citizen in prison. California's like, you're good now. So after 7 years in 1969, he was released.
So he only served half the time. Well, a little less than half.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That is nuts, dude.
So
California loves their criminals.
They sure do. they must like leaving content for us or making content for us.
Absolutely.
So do you think he's good now? Like, do you think he's on the straight and narrow?
No, there's no way. We don't even have a murder yet, so there's no way.
Well, you're absolutely correct. How long do you think it took him to make another offense?
Same week.
No. He did wait a little bit longer than that.
Oh, wow. Well, okay. We'll go as far as a year.
Half that. 6 months.
Wow, 6 months. All right.
6 months. And he got caught though right away. he tried to kidnap a 22-year-old woman. And he was caught in the attempt of trying to kidnap her with the intention to rape. So once again, he was thrown in jail and got another 15-year sentence. So how long do you think he served of the 15?
So I would say the same amount, 7-8 years.
Close, 9.
He was a good boy.
He was a good boy, but they still made him go 9 years at least. They're all, hey, good enough now. It's almost 1980.
How do you not just throw the book at a guy like that? Like, you already kidnapped one woman, attempted to murder a cop, and then you get out 6 months later. Now you're attempting to kidnap it. Like, at that point, it's like, you're not fit to be in society. Stay in there.
Yeah, yeah. He's likely better off in jail, but, man, he gets out.
Who makes the call to get you out of jail early? Is it the governor?
Well, no. What happens is usually, like, when you're in jail, it's the people that take care of your wing of the prison. So whatever wing you're in, if you're a model prison, if you're a prisoner and you're, what is it called, participating in their sort of like activities, whether it's something like, hey, you know, let's make something for the kids, or let's make a, you're like, you're volunteering for work, you know, and you're helping the state out. You're like, hey, I want to be a chef, or I want to be a server in the kitchen. I want to do this. I want to do that. If you're constantly being good, staying out of trouble, they bump you to the top of the list. And then before you know it, you're on the warden's list as far as guys who are, you know, could be up for an early release. You know, that's how that works.
People that shouldn't even be allowed to participate in anything like that. Like, for some people, when you're in there, you deserve to just be in there forever.
Yeah. I get it. People deserve a second chance, but when you got like so much against you and you've got a rap sheet and it's proven that, hey, well, maybe you're a model prisoner here. Maybe this is where you belong. You need that structure. You need that kind of policing. Cause once you're on the outside, you're at your free will, and we know your free will sucks.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah. So he was paroled. And he was sent to a halfway house. So he's still at least being monitored in that way. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't help us because we have a date, Randy.
Oh, shoot. Here we go.
Here we go. So August 19th, 1979, David Carpenter left the halfway house in the morning, driving to Marion County, just outside of San Francisco. It's got a bunch of wildlife and hiking paths that give a beautiful view of the Bay Area, the surrounding foothills, and the downtown area. People have been up there that do their jogging, taking their dogs for a walk, nature, you know, looking at birds and whatnot and over there, and then, you know, riding their bikes, fishing, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So 44-year-old Etta Kane was a bank executive for one of the companies downtown, one of the high-rise companies, and did a lot of good stuff for the bank and was a high executive there.
Gotcha.
And she usually would have certain friends, you know, they like what happens today. They have their running shoes on. They have their Starbucks mugs. They have their, you know, their podcast that they listen to, but in one ear, but they're talking to their friend, you know, or they're just doing that hike together. You know, they have a group of people that they usually go with or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, but this particular time, and her husband would go on to say, this was like a rare occasion she decided to go by herself because no one else was available. Usually she'd be like, nah, I'm not going to go by myself. Strength in numbers. Take a group. Take a couple, you know, someone else. Yeah. But
you should just always stick with what you always believe to be true. If you don't go out without friends, don't be that one time, because that one time is all it's going to take.
That's an excellent point, Randy. She should have stuck with her gut. She should have had an outlet to maybe be like, okay, well, if I can't do this, maybe I just go to the gym.
Yeah. You know? Yep.
But unfortunately, she decided to go against her gut. She went there, and in the evening, you know, her husband didn't see that she was home. She had these two people were those type of couple that had a routine, and if they either one of them went outside the routine, they knew something was up.
Right.
So when she didn't come home, he didn't take too long to call the cops.
Okay.
And the cops didn't initially act upon it until they sent a patrolman into the park that she usually would start her hike at. And her car was there when everybody else was gone by evening time. That's when the cops were like, okay, there's something here. Uh-huh. And so that night, the police, the local police, San Francisco cops, decided to bring out the dogs, and they started to go up and down the trail, looking into the areas that were, you know, possibly where she could be. Maybe she fell, because there are some steep areas that overlook the Golden Gate Bridge. Maybe she tumbled by accident. There's no one else around. And as they were going through there, one of the dogs went off the path about a good 200 yards.
Oh, wow.
And the dog would help find some clothes at first, and also a naked body, which was hers. She had been sexually assaulted. And what was weird about this one was, being naked, her jewelry and her ID and her wallet were like around her, like in a circle. And she was found on her knees, naked, shot in the back of the head with a .44 caliber gun, execution style.
Wow.
So sort of begging for her life at the end, but completely naked, and then just executed.
Poor girl.
Still on her knees, which the police were like, wow, you know, how did she not slump over?
He probably positioned her like that.
Good point.
She probably did slump over. I mean, that's the body's natural way of kind of just, you know, when you shut down, you know, it's like when you sleep, you fall asleep if you're standing up. I've done it plenty of times at work. I mean, you just like, your body just naturally does that. So he had to have positioned her like that. I mean, because you said the things were around her in a circle, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he propped her up. It's some kind of calling card, it seems. I don't know.
Yeah, and that is highly baffling to the police, because on normal cases like this, you know, I hate to call it normal, but, you know, you don't see, like you said, clothes, jewelry, wallet, money, you know, around the person unless it's some sort of ritual.
Ritual, good. That's the word I was looking for, ritual.
Yeah. And so the thing is, too, you have clubs up there that love to go hiking. So the trail buffs, as they called them, were highly investigated, because they're like, well, who would know about this certain area? You know, like, this is a part of the trail. Like, only someone with knowledge of this area would know about this clearing, would know about this area right here. You just don't walk 200 yards off in this particular area to find the specific spot where this woman's body was found, because it was a spot where there was an opening to where if you were to be searching by helicopter, you could find the body. But otherwise, you would not find it without the help of dogs.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So
it's deep in the brush.
It's deep in the brush. It's off the beaten path. It's not
easy. It reminds me of an episode of Highway to Heaven I watched. It's literally that scenario where the helicopter's looking for this missing woman, and they could not find her because this missing car because they could not find it because of the brush was just completely surrounded. They had to bring the dogs in. Crazy. Mm-hmm.
It is crazy. So they were interrogated. No, everyone was ruled out. So at the age of 49, he made his first killing. Wow. You know, so we have another date as that case went cold. March of 1980, 23-year-old Barbara Schwartz decided to take the same hiking trail on a day, but she had her dog with her at least. Mm-hmm. And now this incident happened in broad daylight.
Okay.
So this was not like an evening, a dusk, or a morning, a dawn type situation. He ran into Barbara and began to talk to her. It's not knowing what they started talking about as far as if it was her dog, if it was a beautiful day, the hiking trail, but the two struck up a conversation out of nowhere. Then David, out of nowhere, once he got her guard down, he pulled out a knife and he pulled her off the path a little bit, not even a lot, and he got her into a kneeling position, stripped her naked first, and then got her into a kneeling situation. Then he began to stab her in the chest.
Oh, dude.
So he's not using the 44 caliber. He's using a knife.
Jesus.
And she begins to scream as she's getting, obviously, her life is flashing before her eyes. I can't imagine the pain and suffering that she's going through at this moment.
Right, yeah.
This
is the dog like trying to attack him or something?
No, the dog's just barking. It's not one of those dogs that's threatening. Mm-hmm. So it's not like something that's going to like just go into flight or fight mode and try to save its owner.
Gotcha.
So it's intimidated too. It doesn't know what's going on. But she's screaming so loud, the dog's barking. There's other people that are now like, oh my God, something's happening. They kind of see them behind, you know, off the corner there. And so some of them run. Some of them stayed at, they're not trying to intervene because they don't have weapons, but others run down the hill to try to get to the ranger station and tell the authorities. So then finally some of the hikers come up there to try to, you know, they grab some sticks and try to come at them.
I mean, you're in the like the woods or whatever. There should be broken branches that are pretty thick. Pick one of those up and use it as a club.
Yeah, or bring a rock or something. Throw a rock.
Yeah.
If he's not using a gun, but I mean, it's hard to like in the moment. You know what I mean? Like it's one of those things where
that's fair.
It's hard to would me or you act like that? It's right. You know, like react like that. It's hard to.
You gotta try to have a clear mind all while in an adrenaline rush. That's totally fair.
Yeah, because some people are built to just, hey, you know, that car's on fire and I'm gonna pull that person out. Some people are like, let me grab my camera. Some people are like, I don't want to risk my life. It's just it depends.
Everybody's
on
fire different.
Absolutely. Yep, good point.
Totally right, man.
So, you know, by this time, the hikers got down to a safe spot to where they were able to notify some authorities. The authorities ran up there, but as they started to chase David, he ran into the brush and he would get away. The authorities got up there to try to save her, but by the time they got to her, it was too late. She had bled out and he left her in that same kind of position. She was, you know, tied up, naked, and she couldn't defend herself from multiple just strikes to the chest.
Jeez.
So, terrible way to die.
Absolutely.
And at this point, you know, the only thing they had was a, you know, description, a light description of a white male with glasses, a little bit of receding hair. And that's about it. You know, he's wearing hiking boots and that's about it. That's all they had. So, you know, the community is trying to, you know, is now in shock because this is two people that were, you know, two women that were innocently murdered, you know, just going out for a hike. And this is supposed to be a safe area. And this is within a year. So they didn't, the police. Now here's your second set of Johnsons. Two murders on the same hiking trail, mere, not even a mile between both murder scenes. And even though it's the logic for the Johnsons was, hey, one murder was used with a gun and the other one was with a knife. So these, we're looking for two suspects.
Even not though it's more. Been in the same area. Wow.
And even though the women were stripped the same way.
Yeah, in the same position too.
Yeah. Like, nah, this is a different guy.
Wow. Cracker Jack freaking sheriff badges.
Yeah, exactly. Mine says sheriff. Mine says police.
Mine says sheriff.
Yeah. Oh, man. Mine's a sticker.
Gotta love the Johnson, baby.
Gotta love him. Gotta love him. So just a couple months later, same year, it was a, this, you know, same kind of hiking trail, a little bit different. Mrs. Alderson, at the age of 26, was found near Mount Pilas in Marion County, just outside Santa Cruz. She had been sexually assaulted, however, viciously, like just, she had some sexual wounds down there, unfortunately. Man. She was too stripped of all clothes, not missing any kind of rings or necklaces. It was all there, but spread out. She was completely naked, and she too was shot in the back of the head with a .44 caliber handgun. So this is a second one. Same position.
Now this one, since he didn't have to run away like he did in the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do the whole circle of stuff around her?
Correct.
At the calling card.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's to let him know. That's to let the Johnsons know we are dealing with the same dude.
And, you know, back then, you know, the media was more pressuring on the police. They actually did their homework. They followed these guys. They wanted the scoop. So, yeah, and as soon as the journalists in the San Francisco Bay Area found out that this, that through their source in the police force, that these three cases were eerily similar, they were ready to run with the article in the morning. The Trailside Killer strikes again. We have a serial killer in the Bay Area. Well, before they could do that, it was leaked that someone leaked it to them. So the police are like, we got to get ahead of this one. Let's set up a press conference. And they were forced to say there's a serial killer on the loose.
Man. So,
they didn't want to look bad that the media knew before they were alleging to tell the public.
Yeah.
So there you had it. You had the Trailside Killer now in Marion County. And now you had detectives from all over flocking to the trails. You had undercover police. You had helicopters. They were watching that entire area. They're like, oh man, we can't let another innocent young woman die.
Yep.
And so it began to get national attention. And as they were focusing their attention on that huge area, that forest area, a couple months later, David said, well, that's getting too much heat over there. I'm going to go further north to Point Reyes National Seashore Park. And this is where young Shauna, at the age of 25, would go missing just a few months later. But prior to her going missing in that area, the Johnsons not linking the cases of the three people at that point, they would find Shauna McKay 2 days later after finding Shauna McKay, I should say, the third body, or after the first body, I'm sorry, searchers would come along a grisly sight. So this is after the three bodies were found in that area. He had been at work prior to Shauna McKay's murder up there. They found not one, not two, not three, but four bodies.
Four bodies. And this is after the initial three?
Yeah, this is after the initial three.
Oh, man.
And they would find the body of Shauna McKay, who was missing. I'm sorry, she was missing after the first murders. They found Shauna McKay's body, same way, 44 caliber, clothes and everything spread out. Then you would find right next to her, mere feet, 22-year-old Diane O'Connell. Same way. Same caliber bullet hole. That was his, and both were raped and murdered. So these were sexually assaulted as well, these two young ladies. And Diane, though, was shot not just one time, but multiple times. Man. And so basically they were thinking that Shauna's body was there 2 months prior. So this was becoming his little dumping ground. And as they were searching, as they were searching the area and, you know, collecting more evidence, imagine being the detective or the police officer, and then you stray about 40 feet or so away from the crime scene where you found already two bodies, which is traumatic in itself. Mm-hmm. You stumble upon two other bodies. You stumble upon a 19-year-old Richard Stowers, so a man, and an 18-year-old Cynthia Moreland.
She's the youngest one.
Yep. Both of them had been shot in the back of the head, face down, though, hidden in some brush. So he hid these bodies in the brush, sort of like he was not pleased with these two. Mm. So now you have four bodies found within an hour to 2 hours after the initial one.
And no real motive behind it other than he just wanted to. It was all planned.
Mm-hmm. It could have been like I think the more it was more with the one woman that was stabbed. I think that was just a crime of opportunity. Mm. But I think you're right with these other ones. These were planned. He probably stalked these people up and down the trail because
what a sicko.
That was his outlet, was the trails. He liked to go up and down the trails. So he got pretty familiar with the area.
Dude, how are they not fine combing these areas looking for this guy at this point?
Well, at this point, Randy, you're right. The FBI was called in, and the National Guard. The governor authorized the National Guard to where they put in heat-seeking helicopters. They were doing everything they possibly could.
California governor willing to do something? Holy damn.
You know, that was a long time ago. Yep. And it also just, you know, a week or two later, you know, basically it may have been about a week or so, maybe a few days even. But they were able to, they already knew that these cases had to be all related because of all the MO, the circumstances were all the same. But it was just made official when they saw that the 44 caliber bullets matched the other ones.
A big one right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one.
So for 6 weeks, the FBI, the National Guard, police, undercover detectives were swarming all over that area. But and adjacent parks, everything. They threw everything they had at it now that you had seven bodies and nothing.
Wow.
Still nothing. And people stayed off the hiking trails because, I mean, you had enough heat. I mean, what's nature with helicopters flying all over the place and
right.
Cops everywhere? People are like, nope, and there's a murderer out there? Never mind. I'm good. And the fact that it was released that a 19-year-old man was killed. So he's not straying from killing, you know, killing men now, so like why would you risk it at all? So unfortunately, you know, we have another date, and it's 21-year-old Ellen Hansen from UC Davis and her boyfriend, Stephen Hartley, decided to go camping in Henry Cal State Park March 29th, 1981. The couple went on a hike the next morning after camping, and they ran into a slender older man with a baseball cap and glasses. The man, which was David, ordered the two off the trail because, again, he started with pleasantries. He seems like a non-assuming, threatening guy. You know, he doesn't look like much, but he pulled a handgun on him, which was a .44 caliber. And Ellen began to scream as he marched the two into the forest. And as she turned around, she was told to stop screaming. She kind of flipped out, put her hands up, and was screaming some more. He shot her twice in the face.
Are all these areas where all these incidents happen, are they in proximity?
Yeah, because that whole area is off the beaten path. It's within, I would say all these hiking areas and forest areas are within about a good 20 miles of each other. They're not too far.
He's obviously hiding, staying in the area. I'd have everybody as far as I can go in every national park that's there, every campground, dude. I'd have the manpower out there, bro, because he's obviously sticking around in the area.
Yeah, yeah, he's not traveling too far. Even the most, you know, the other areas he's going into, it's not that far of a drive.
Mm-hmm.
So, she was shot, and Steven turned around and ran as she was shot because he felt she was dead before she hit the ground. And he shot twice and hit Steven in the back. And the handgun makes a lot of noise. And there was an observation tower within about 300 yards or less where there was a lot of people that were sightseers that were coming from other cities or states or even countries. Mm-hmm. They heard the gunshots, and, you know, half the crowd will stay in place and the other half will be like, "What's that?" and run towards it, you know? So yep. You had a lot of people heading towards the sound of those gunshots. And he decided, hey, he's hearing people run his way. He's got to get out of there. And there was a couple people he passed, including a little girl who caught a good glimpse of him. And they saw him get into a red small car, and take off. And, you know, they saw him with glasses and everything. And he gets, fortunately, and people there in time to save Steven. The people get there in time. They call for help. He's able to survive, but he loses his girl. And you know, Carpenter, you know, David's freaking out because now people have seen him, and there's a description of him. You know, they have a really good description of what he looks like, because not only the little girl saw him, but there was a couple other people that saw a good description. So they have a better drawing of what he kind of looked like. And I got to post that drawing, by the way. It's pretty spot on for what he looked like.
Okay.
And so he freaks out. And at this time, he's not having to live at the halfway house anymore. He's got a job. He's got his own apartment. But now he's like, I got to come home and live with my parents now. You know, people might recognize me. If I come home with my parents, you know, people haven't seen me around here in a long time, I'll stay low profile with them. So that's what he did. He started to get a factory job that was a different from his normal job. You know, working a different shift, changed his hair color, his hairstyle, his clothing. So he's
trying hard to look different.
Yeah, because once he saw the artist renditions on TV, he's like, oh man, you know, I got to change things up.
Yeah.
But, as much as he sounds freaked out and you think that this is the end of the story until maybe DNA rolls around, his urges take control of him again. And on May 1st, 1981, Carpenter at his new job after, you know, working a factory job, seen a 20-year-old by the name of Heather Skaggs. And she needed a car. And it was evident that she was tired of taking public transportation, getting dropped off by her boyfriend, stuff like that. And she had been putting the word out that she needs to get a used car, or she needs to buy a car. You know, she's got some money. And at this time, you know, he's 51 years old. And he said casually in front of a couple other coworkers, "Hey, I can give you a ride to a dealership. I know of a great place that sells cars. And because they know me, they could possibly hook you up." So that got her attention, and she was all happy. And she's like, "You know what? This guy's not bad after all." You know, in her mind, she's thinking, "I heard he was always awkward. He was this, he was that." And she called her boyfriend in lunchtime and said, "Hey, I'm going to go with David, you know, here at work to go check out a car. He has a hookup." And her boyfriend told her, "Listen, I don't like that. You know, I've heard something, you know, you talk about him, and if he's on the weird side, you know, why don't you just wait for me to take you?" And she's like, "Well, you know, he might have a hookup, blah, blah, blah." So he tells her, "If I don't hear from you, you know, by the time I get home at 7 p.m., I'm calling the police." She's like, okay, don't worry about it. And
thanks for playing.
Yep. So, and that's what would hurt him later on, you know, and her, because by the time 7 p.m. came and went, she was nowhere to be heard from. Co-workers hadn't heard from David as well. And they would say that he seemed like, you know, when the police came over there after the boyfriend called and started interviewing people the next morning, they were saying, you know, David seems like a, you know, awkward person, but I don't think he would kill. You know, something happened because she hasn't responded. Obviously, there's no cell phones at the time, but you can't track a person like you could today.
Right.
But she hasn't checked in with anybody. She's, you know, she's clearly missing. You know, she's always a hands-on person, never misses work, that type of deal. And some of the people were like, "Well, you know what? He was kind of creepy the way he would look at women. You know, he stuttered when he was nervous." And so when the police start looking at him, they're like, "Man, you know, he drives a red car, and he looks a lot like that high profile case of the sketches. You know, this isn't a trail killing, but, you know, this woman's missing, you know." And some of the cops actually start to not be Johnson, and they're like, "What if this is a crime of opportunity? You know, what if this is our trail guy?"
Mm-hmm.
And one of the investigators for the FBI that does those profiles, they're like, "Your killer's most likely a white male, receding hairline, a stuttering problem, a life of abuse as a kid." He nailed it all.
Yeah, he did.
So
well,
once
I worked for the FBI.
Yeah, exactly. So once the police got the FBI profile on their killer, they're like, "This has got to be the dude."
Yeah. You know,
lives with his parents, that type of deal. So they question him. They come to his parents' house and they're like, Do you know Heather Skaggs?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, you know, I know her from work. What's wrong?" "Well, she was the last one seen with you. We haven't seen her, and you know, you can fill in the blanks." So he's like, you know, as he's in the interrogation room, he's just not saying much, very closed off. He's stuttering a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, "Man, you know, look, there's something to this." And the more and more they ask him questions, they try to dive into his background. And he just, they're getting nowhere. So they're like 3 hours into the interrogation, and the detective decides, you know, as they're looking through his file, he's, you know, looking through the glass window, and he's like, "Let me take a crack at David. Mm-hmm. I got an idea." So check this out, Randy. He goes in there, he sits down, he goes, "Hey, I'm Detective so-and-so, and you know, we've been working on this case, and you know, we really want to find Heather." And he goes, I got to get to know you because I saw your file, and I think we can, you know, strike up a conversation about something that doesn't even deal with this." He goes, "I'm impressed." And David's like, "Impressed by what?" He's like, "You know, as a kid, I didn't like it at first, but my mom made me take ballet." And he's like, "I did it for years. and he started naming these schools that he went to, and the detective was being truthful, but he was using that angle. He's like, I hated it at times because I was the only male in the class. And then he said David sat up, looked at him in a trance, and then he stood up, and the police were like, is he going to pull something? Is he going to lunge at him? Is he mad because he thinks he's making fun of him? It's hard to say this with a straight face.
Oh, no.
David looks at him and starts to perform ballet moves in the interrogation room with a straight face.
Oh, wow.
And the detective is like, interesting. Okay. So this went on for several minutes. So there's no music. There's just him on his tippy toes performing ballet moves in an interrogation room probably the size of a garage. Yeah. And he's just, you know, kind of like just performing these pirouettes or whatever the hell they call them. And when he stops, I mean, what are you going to do? You just reached him in a certain way. So the both detectives, including the one that told him, hey, I took ballet, was like, great job. That's impressive, David. And so once again,
trying to pull that whole trying to be your friend thing.
Absolutely. He was definitely the good cop right there.
Yeah,
absolutely. So he sits down and he's quiet for a minute, and you know, they keep him on, they ask him again about the rape, and about anything else that he knows. And then all he says is, I hope they find her and that she hasn't been raped and murdered. And then he shuts down. So he just stops.
A little strange, but okay.
So in my opinion, that was him telling on himself. Like, hey, I raped and murdered her. I hope you find her.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it the other way. And without implicating himself. So with nothing really to hold him on, no clear evidence because they don't have the weapon, they don't have anything, they put him on 24-hour surveillance.
Yeah.
And as they watched him for almost a week, they got a call from San Jose, which is, you know, a little bit south of Frisco, or to the east, I believe, something like that. There was hikers on a trail, and they found the body of Heather Skaggs. Yeah, and she was in that prone position, and she had been sexually assaulted. And at the same time, while they have him under surveillance, Stephen, who was shot in the back, was recovering and was able to finally talk to police, and they showed him David's picture, and he positively identified him as the murderer.
Oh, wow.
So you had that finally. So after that was confirmed, and the day of the, you know, that all took place, he was, you know, arrested, charged with the murders, and only recently were they able to get him charged for all those murders. There's still a couple, two or three that they are that they can't link him to, or they haven't linked him to, but he's suspected of. So it could be upwards to 10.
He's still alive?
Well, here's the thing. It took till 1988 for him to finally get sentenced because of all the cases and all the evidence and just a lot of BS in the California judicial system. And he was sentenced to death. However, California decided to do away with the death penalty, and he is he didn't have to, like a lot of these serial killers, a lot of these ones in California, they die in death row.
Yeah.
And you know, we've seen the Night Stalker die of late. Manson died, you know, all those guys should have been put to death.
Oh yeah.
But they survived, and well, this guy is no exception. He's going to be turning 94 next month. He's still alive.
Where's he locked up at?
San Quentin.
Oh, okay.
That used to be a place where they used to execute prisoners all the time.
Yep, sure did.
So due to also he's 93, going to be 94. He's been also linked to three other rapes, some that were that they found evidence in 2009. They re-examined the case of Mary Frances Bennett on October 21st, 1979. She was at the Land's End jogging area. A rape kit was grabbed from her. And that linked another murder right there. And then in 2010, they also linked another murder and another one to give him a total of 10. Actually, it should be, they're thinking there might be up to 13 because they're still investigating a few others. So this guy killed 10 confirmed plus three rapes, and he's still alive at going to be 94 next month.
Man, his past is just the gift that keeps on giving, huh?
Yep.
Seems like every time they turn around, they're finding another victim that they can tie to this cat.
And all that open area, Randy, I mean, there's people that have disappeared in the forest. Like, we have one here in San Bernardino where the kid went with a big group of high school kids, and he disappeared. They found his camera, and he was out there overnight. They tried everything to find him. They still haven't found him 25 years later. There's no skeletal remains. So, you know, sometimes animals can bury it. Weather conditions. I'm pretty sure there's a few more up there. There's got to be.
Yeah. It's like you said, up in those areas, man, you know, after the body's been there a while, it's, you know, those animals start smelling it, decomposing and all that. Yeah, it doesn't take long for them to pick those things clean, and then bones just get scattered, I think, at that point.
Absolutely. And then you got to keep in mind, too, Randy, there's a lot of people that live in the back area that they're not in the city to where their parents or their family members, they're disconnected. Because in California, there's a lot of people that are just, you know, come from other areas that they don't really have big families. So if they go missing for a long time, no one really questions it.
Right.
And there's transients. So maybe he got a hold of a few transients, too. We know we have that problem in California. So, yeah, it's unfortunate, man. That's what serial killers usually prey upon. So,
yeah.
But that's the story of David Carpenter, man. Still freaking alive.
What a piece of crap.
Yeah, man. I mean, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on this case about the police handling it and just the way that this dude was able to stay and get out of prison so many times?
Well, I'll tell you, the local police just kept fumbling this thing, man. It's a good thing they just finally, you know, were able to hand it over to the FBI, and the FBI just took it from there, man, because I feel like if they didn't go that route, I think there'd be a lot more questions than answers today.
Correct.
So, but it just sucks, dude. I mean, all these women it's like you said earlier in the episode, just can't imagine what goes through these people's head, man or woman, you know, when they know they're gonna die.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the scariest one to me. I mean, at least with a gun, it sounds bad, but it's swift. You know, it's like sort of like...
Especially if you can't see it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I just feel for the woman that was on her knees begging for her life and taking... You're seeing the knife come into your chest. You're not going to die automatically.
That's suffering.
Yeah, that's torture at that point, man.
I mean, that's like on the levels of drowning or burning to death.
Correct.
You feel that all the way till the end.
Yeah. And you know, like, I don't know if you've ever been like cut kind of bad.
Oh yeah.
You know, like, you know, where you needed stitches, but you do
right there, I mean, between my pointer finger and my thumb. I was cutting a watermelon one day, pulled the knife too far, didn't realize I cut myself until after 5 minutes, and I realized, and I looked on the floor, and there was literally a puddle of blood and blood just falling from and you could literally see the bone. I'm gonna show you on camera, but right there, that bone right there. Mm-hmm. When I have my hand open like this, you can literally see that bone, dude.
Damn.
12 stitches right there. Bam. And about 15 minutes of soaking that bad boy in iodine at the hospital.
Oh, I bet. Trying to make sure it doesn't get infected.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like with that kind of stuff, it's like you either get a cut like that and you bleed a lot and you don't feel anything.
Right.
Or if you're stabbed or punctured with something, that sucker burns. I remember I was punctured in the thigh. I was like, God damn. And I'm like, I knew right away. I'm like, oh, crap. That got into like the fatty tissue of my thigh, dude.
And imagine like people who get like stabbed like in the lung area, dude. And you're just grasping for air.
Oh,
you're probably choking on blood, too.
Yeah.
Oh, bro.
I mean, that is terrible because again, it's not the same thing. But I've only choked once because I remember trying to take a sleeping pill. Mm-hmm. And it was like a horse pill. And I'm not good with taking pills. Either, and so I took it, and then like it got stuck in my throat, and I remember my brother-in-law had to give me a quick Heimlich, you know, for me to, and it was like the second pump to my chest or stomach, and I coughed it out, and that scared the living bejesus out of me.
Hell, like, yeah, it does. Your life flashes before your eyes when you choke.
That's exactly what I was gonna say. So like you bringing up that point with you're choking on your own blood or you're just struggling to, dude, that is something I don't want on anyone else to feel. Right. And I sure as hell don't want to feel that myself.
I mean, there's times, you know, because I'm a gargler, you know, when I'm brushing my teeth, you know, mm-hmm. I rinse the whole area, man. And sometimes, you know, I'll gargle and all of a sudden, like, I'll swallow water and like, oh, and I'll start like, and you can like literally feel yourself drowning until you're like you literally got to make yourself throw up. It's scary, dude. And that's just me just brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
Man.
It literally tells you how fragile life is.
Yeah. And the one disregard wrong, of life some people have.
Yeah. One wrong move and you know, you're either doing it to yourself or someone does it to you and it's like, damn, that's it.
And that goes to my point, like I said earlier in the episode, always go with your gut instinct. Don't, it's like I said, like if you do something all the time as a group with friends and there's one time that nobody can make it, don't go out by yourself. If you always have a gut feeling, so no, I don't do these things by myself. This is why I go out with friends. Stay your ass home.
Correct.
Or like you said, you know, drive to the gym, or just hop on a treadmill or something. You know, one time and not going out with your friends and missing the trail isn't going to kill you.
Yeah.
It's gonna keep you alive in this situation. So, and I hate to joke about that, but. But just always trust your gut instinct, man, because it doesn't steer you wrong.
No.
It doesn't steer you wrong. I do it all the time. I did it, you know, working with security when I was doing security. Like, you have to trust your gut instinct, man. It will always steer you in the right direction, even if it's nothing. Safer than sorry.
Yeah. You literally don't want to put yourself in that position.
No.
You know, goes without saying.
Yep. So. But as much as it was a horrific story, it was a good story, and I appreciate you sharing that with us today, brother.
I appreciate it, man.
And prayers to all the victims and the families that were involved, man. And that piece of crap can go to hell, and unfortunately he has to rot on his way there.
Yeah, you kind of wish this case took place in Texas. He wouldn't have made it past 2 years.
No, they put an it's like Ron White said, we don't have the death penalty here in California, but in Texas they put in an express line.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, is it.
That is true. Here's the last thing I got on this too, is since you said you feel for the families and everybody that was involved, I do as well, because not just for what they went through and everything, but again, to you don't think, I mean, if we know the fact that he's alive still, they obviously know that he's alive still. And maybe some of them are good with him being in there till his dying day. But, you know, there's a vast majority of them is like, man, this guy should be dead a long time ago. Like, why is he alive and our loved ones are gone? You know,
absolutely. So. It's life's unfair in that regard, man. And imagine the people that went so many years without even knowing.
Correct.
You know, so many years without any closure.
Yeah.
And they had to wait for closure, and they got to realize, well, this guy's not even going to pay. He's already locked up, but he's not going to pay any further for what he's done to our families.
Yeah. I mean, those people waited like 30 to 31 years. So
that sucks.
Does suck. But that's our story.
I appreciate you sharing that with me, brother.
You got it. That's our story for tonight. We'll have another one here soon. We won't be taking this kind of time off. So we're going to be filling in where we can until Matt and Gabby come back, and or we get we get on the right page again. So we'll have some more updates on that as we move forward. But for Todd Fox and the one and only Randy,
thank y'all for listening.
Y'all come back now, you hear?